We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy. How are you today, Lynn? Thanks for joining me.
I'm good. Thanks for having me back.
Of course, it's always a pleasure. Lynn, in your recent April 2024 newsletter, you go through explaining the periods where a 60-40 portfolio does well and when they do poorly. So I thought it was very interesting the way that you really distilled this idea down after more explanation to go short abundant things and go long scarce things. As you say, this is a great first step in analyzing investments. So let's maybe start by getting an understanding of how you see this era of fiscal dominance resulting in an era of bonds being among the most abundant things around, and understanding, let's say, why the projections from the Congressional Budget Office for the next decade accounts for no recessions and for the interest rates to be lower than they currently are.
Sure. And so, you know, when you look at the budget deficit, there's a couple main components. And I think it's worthwhile stepping back a little bit. Over the past 40 years, we have these series of credit growth. So during an economic expansion, the private sector is taking on more debt. And during recessions, they do some degree of deleveraging, especially relative to GDP and things like that. But during those deleveraging moments, there's a variety of automatic stabilizers, as well as reduction in tax receipts, as well as purposeful kind of one-time stimulus that go in. And so what happens is a lot of that private debt that gets deleveraged instead gets transferred to the public ledger. And so if you actually look at total debt, public and private, it virtually never goes down. It only went down for like 1% during a 12-month period around the global financial crisis. For like 70 years straight, it's like nothing but a smooth lineup. But it shifts around a little bit where it is. And starting with the global financial crisis in particular, but really every recession, but especially that moment, these accumulated private debts relative to a fairly small monetary base and relative to things like that, a lot of that debt started getting transferred to the public ledger. Not directly. They don't just say, we're going to take that debt, but they say, look, we're going to recapitalize the banks by issuing all this stuff, and then we're going to issue bonds to pay for it. Or we're going to give out PPP loans that turn into grants. Or we're going to give out corporate bailouts. Or we're going to give out stimulus checks, or whatever the case may be. We're going to keep raising Social Security payments despite the fact that our tax receipts are no longer covering them. Whatever the case may be, running these deficits. And so you're kind of bailing out some of the income statements of private entities and doing that by issuing more public bonds. And we generally see this over time. When Japan had their huge bubble in the late 80s, early 90s, massive debt buildup, they went through 30 years of private sector deleveraging. So their highly levered corporations were slowly deleveraging while their public sector was leveraging up. It was kind of the slow motion transfer. Right. And we've seen that happen before. I studied the period a lot in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s to get some analogs for today. It's kind of the last time the Western world, the developed Western world, went through this kind of big debt transfer cycle. And you kind of see that play out. And so far, we're kind of seeing it play out just, with obviously there's different characteristics 80 years later in a more information-based economy. But ultimately, under the surface, the same thing's kind of happening, is that private debt is rotating onto the public sector. Mm-hmm. And when you have a private debt bubble, that is disinflationary, because anytime debt kind of starts being repaid back or defaulting, that's actually reducing the money supply or otherwise slowing the prior growth of money supply. Whereas when you have very large fiscal deficits, especially if they're monetized by the central bank or the banking system more broadly, that is inflationary. And then it becomes a question of relative magnitudes. So in the global financial crisis, they ran big deficits, but those were roughly equivalent to the loan losses. And so you didn't really have, you kind of prevented deflation, for better or worse, mm-hmm. but you didn't really get major positive inflation. Or another way of putting it is you had big inflation from a negative baseline. Whereas what we saw more recently, and this is normal with kind of late stage debt cycles, is that during the whole pandemic and lockdowns, we had massive stimulus, but not really much loan destruction. And so you had a huge increase in the money supply, delayed but substantial increase in aggregate prices as well. And what kind of makes this deficit kind of hard to deal with is that it's so accumulated, right? So if you just were running large deficits, but you had an economy that was not financialized and you had a low debt to GDP ratio, then it'd be fairly easy. It'd be hard in the sense that you'd have to cut things that are popular or raise taxes in an unpopular way. But it's the numbers would kind of be fairly simple if you can get past the political hurdles to kind of rein in the deficit. But when you have accumulated debts, and a lot of that is now interest expense building up, that's extremely hard to deal with. And then secondly, the U.S. economy in particular, compared to say other Western economies, is more financialized, which means that a bigger percentage of our tax receipts are based on things like executive compensation, which is largely tied to stock issuance, which means it's heavily tied to stock prices, like stock performance in a given year, as well as, you know, just kind of how we've structured things. And so whenever we get kind of asset prices going flat to down for a year or more, generally the next year's tax receipts are weak. And so the deficit kind of blows out. And so overall, we've built up this kind of huge, not only a political machine of structural deficits, but also just the mathematically, that even if you got, you know, all the most fiscal hawks in office, they would probably have trouble cutting the deficit by any meaningful degree. Because even if you cut it, you probably end up slowing down GDP and ironically blowing out the deficit further because they let it metastasize to this point. Mm-hmm. And so normally what happens at this point is that the train's off the tracks. Nothing stops this train in the sense that really kind of running it hot and inflating it away is kind of mathematically one of the few options that they have. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where they're at right now. So I would say the combination of very high public debts, substantial ongoing deficits, and then pretty substantial interest payments on those existing debts has kind of put them past the event horizon where the set of choices they have is now very narrow. And so we're in this era of just deficits as far as the eye can see are going to be trillions of dollars per year. Mm-hmm. And so that what that should translate into is higher average fiscal-driven inflation. And now, what that manifests in prices depends on what the baseline is. So if we get a big productivity growth, let's say AI or something like that, or new energy source, then that could be pretty positive inflation off a very deep negative baseline. So you could get low inflation. On the other hand, if you have headwinds, you have things, for example, deglobalization, or AI does not take off as quickly as people think. Whatever the, you know, if tech or productivity driven deflation is not significant, then that fiscal driven inflation is on top of a baseline that is, you know, not very negative. And then you can get substantial price inflation. And so I think that's the era that we're in now. And that gives us similar eras to, for example, 1940s Western world. Or if you look at emerging markets, it happens all the time in recent decades, where basically fiscal deficits on an annual basis are larger than the sum of new bank loans and new corporate bond issuance. And so the credit cycles, while still important, are downplayed in their importance. And the size of the deficit is actually a key macro variable, a key investing variable, as well as obviously the political variable that it has. And that's something we have to kind of reorient around. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's so much to pick up on there, Lynn, but let's start with what you see, let's say, as the likelihood for the Federal Reserve to have, you know, finally perfectly fine-tuned the economy to avoid recession for the next decade.
Well, so I would say no, but I would say that if you have recessions in emerging markets, they tend to look different, right? When we think of recessions in the developed world, we think of a disinflationary credit crunch. Right, we think of a big spike in unemployment. We think of asset prices going down nominally. We think of all those type of things. But when you look at recessions in the emerging world, often in their local currency, stocks go up. Unemployment might not spike, but everybody's poorer because their income buys them less energy or buys them less imports, for example. They feel squeezed even though they might still be employed and they might be earning more local currency units than they did last year and the year before. I think basically the U.S. is going through a period that's going to be, it's like a developed market, but with emerging market characteristics. So it means it's not quite the same as an emerging market because, you know, our debt's denominated in our own currency. It's a different situation to some extent. But when you have these kind of structural background fiscal, to the extent that we get a recession in the next 10 years, I think it would be stagflationary more so than this big, you know, kind of deflationary crunch. Mm-hmm. Or to the extent that we even get a minor deflationary crunch, I think it would kind of come out of it quickly and back into a period of either reflation or stagflation. And, you know, to kind of quantify it, for example, what's happening in commercial real estate right now is that that's recessionary. That is disinflationary. That is deflationary. There's loan losses and equity losses on commercial real estate. People are losing their jobs in that area. That sector in isolation is disinflationary. But, you know, most estimates suggest there's something like, you know, $1.5 trillion in equity wiped out from commercial real estate. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, that's 1 year of current federal deficits, right? The US household net worth, when you look at all households together, is something like $140 trillion. So $1.5 trillion is a little over 1% of just kind of damage, right? It's this like small problem that's kind of being rolled over in a much larger structural stimulus. Mm-hmm. And what happens when you get that kind of, you know, fairly tight monetary policy but fairly aggressive fiscal policies is the gap between winners and losers is bigger than normal. So commercial real estate's an outright depression, whereas travel companies are doing fairly well because, mm-hmm. you know, upper middle class and wealthy people, they're generally doing fine. Including, you know, kind of older middle class and upper middle class people that have, you know, they've accumulated assets, they're getting Social Security, they're getting Medicare, as well as just wealthy people of any kind of age. They're still getting their income and they're still spending. Whereas if you have any sort of like short-term debt that has to kind of roll over, like commercial real estate, for example, or credit card debt, those are the people that are being squeezed. And so I think that's kind of how this looks going forward, is that, for example, the sheer rate of unemployment in recessions might be lower than we've experienced in, say, the last two. The rate of disinflation might be lower. But that instead we feel in different ways, that people say, look, I'm still employed, I'm still making an income, but for some reason it's not going as far as it did last year. Mm-hmm. Grocery price, you know, I can buy fewer groceries with my weekly income. That's what people will experience. So I can buy less gasoline with my income, or traveling to visit family this Thanksgiving is prohibitive, right? Whatever the pain point may be, there's more of those pain points. And you know, when you look at emerging market recessions, assets often do decently in their local currency, but they do poorly in dollars or gold terms, like basically a harder money. Mm-hmm. And if you have in the Western world kind of go through that, that basically means that in euros or dollars, you know, assets could do reasonably well, maybe not great, but maybe not as bad as you think, but price in something like gold, they're probably not going to do great, I would argue, over the next decade. That mm-hmm. or when you price them in energy units, for example. How many barrels of oil is the S&P 500 worth? Metrics like that, I expect to be more pressured over the next 10 years than they have been over the prior 10 years. Mm-hmm.
So Lynn, maybe we could contrast this, you know, this commercial real estate situation against the stock market in this era of fiscal dominance. You know, obviously the Fed is concerned in a way by proxy about financial stability because of their triune mandate, I believe is the word you used, right? So how do you see the stock market being at such highs right now? How does that kind of square with this era of fiscal dominance as well?
Well, so going back to, when we look at interest rates as a policy tool to fight inflation, right? There's a couple ways they do that. One, especially for a non-US market, right? If a country's trying to reduce its currency loss, you know, let's say you're Turkey, for example, and nobody wants to hold your currency, and therefore energy in your currency terms is going up a lot. One thing you can do is raise interest rates so that more foreigners want to hold your currency, and fewer people in your country want to try to exit your currency and get foreign currency. You want to have a positive real rate, and that helps kind of stem the growth of say, the price of energy or other commodities or other imports in your currency. That's one reason why interest rates are kind of an inflation-fighting tool. Mm-hmm. The other one is that if most of the money creation is coming from bank lending, then raising rates can slow down borrowing demand, right? I'm less likely to take out a mortgage at 8% than 3%, for example. And then therefore, I'm going to contribute less to money supply growth as a borrower. Those are the main ways that high interest rates slow down inflation. They either slow down the rate of money growth, or they try to stem the loss of FX loss compared to other currencies. Now, if most of the money creation is from the private sector and public sector debt is low, then raising interest rates does have a pretty significant downward effect on inflation through those two variables. The problem is that if you're in an environment of fiscal dominance, which is, you know, you have public debt well over 100% of GDP, then when you raise interest rates, although you do still have those two disinflationary forces, you are slowing down borrowing and you are making your currency more attractive to foreigners. But you are also blowing out your fiscal deficit. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you blow out your interest expense while you have 30% debt to GDP, you know, that's probably a smaller force stimulating than the downward force you're putting on those other two variables. But if you have 120% debt to GDP and you blow out your public interest expense, the sheer size of your ballooning interest expense and therefore your deficits is probably equal or larger than the downward force you're putting on those other two variables. And so I think that basically that's what the US finds itself in now, which is that it, you know, over the past couple of years, it has put downward pressure, especially on interest rate sensitive industries. So if you're in commercial real estate, if you're in the business of residential real estate turnover, right? If your income's reliant on how many houses you sell, you're in a rough state right now. There are sectors that are heavily impaired. But on the other hand, you know, seniors or, you know, wealthy people in general, their money markets are paying them more money than they were 2 years ago. And if you're a large corporation, let's say you're Google or Alphabet, you know, you've got billions of dollars in the proverbial bank. It's like bank cash, and it's actually like T-bills and things like that. And they're now getting more income on their cash hoard than they were 2 years ago. Google's getting a stimulus from these higher rates. You know, if you're a highly levered, you know, entity with fairly short-term debt that you had to refinance at higher rates, like a commercial real estate operator, you were hurt a lot more than you were helped by these higher rates. But if you're on the other side of that, where you don't have a lot of debt, or the debt you do have is low fixed rate, and you have other assets, especially T-bills or money markets or kind of cash equivalents, you got a stimulus from these higher rates, because the sheer amount of ballooning interest expense is bigger than the amount of slowdown that it put on private sector lending. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what we see, is that basically companies that either have decent financial positions or whose customers have decent financial positions are actually, you know, kind of neutrally affected, or in some cases even stimulated by these higher rates in this particular environment. And I would say on average, that group is about equal or larger than the group that's impaired by these higher rates, which is kind of a hallmark of fiscal dominance. And so that's kind of we've gone through the looking glass, kind of some of the rules don't make sense anymore because we're in a different environment. Mm-hmm. But it's not that I'm saying this time is different. I'm saying that when we ask what we're comparing this time to, we have to have the right baseline, right? So we're not comparing to the prior decades of monetary dominance. We're comparing to prior times of fiscal dominance, which is in the Western world, the 1940s. And in the emerging world, there's plenty of examples. And so far, we are behaving just like last time. It's just that last time doesn't mean last decade or the decade prior to that. It means the last time economies like this were in fiscal dominance, which is it's harder to slow down inflation. It's not impossible necessarily, but it's harder. And the fiscal forces are bigger than the private forces. And so we have to account for that in our portfolios, and we still have to be data dependent to see which side's winning at any given time. But that's kind of where we find ourselves in, that interest rates don't have the pure one directional push down effect in the economy that they would have if public debt was lower.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned this era of the 40s and that this problem isn't necessarily unsolvable. What difference in the tools and, you know, the debt to GDP ratio that actually matter at this time versus the 40s, you know, if we're using that as a counterpoint or a counterexample?
Right. So one is that in the 40s, they had a very clear external catalyst. They could do extreme things because they could say, look, the Nazis, right? Mm-hmm. It's like nothing we did. It's like, it's their fault, right? That's how they can, you know, frame it. And in the 40s, you had, in the 30s and 40s, you had, for example, a super majority in Congress of one political party. It was the most kind of pendulum swung very far to one side. You had like this era of we're all in this together, Rosie the Riveter and that kind of vibe, right? We're all in this together. Mm-hmm. And so you could do things that in hindsight were extreme. I mean, you could violate rights. You could do things that are considered extreme today, and people put up with it because that was the mindset of the time. That was where the pendulum had gone after a previously kind of swinging in the other direction. So now they're going through a similar set of circumstances, except the debt is not entirely because of war. It's actually partially because of war. The Iraq wars and all these recent, just accumulated wars is one of the big variables, but also just the way we structured our entitlement programs in a kind of an unsustainable way, any number of reasons. We've kind of built up this imbalance and there's no clear other external catalyst to point to. Right. And so it's less of a clean thing to do. And then there's more political polarization. We have kind of record political polarization. In that sense, it's the complete opposite of the 40s. And in addition, in the 40s, the United States had a structural trade surplus. We were the rising power. We were like what China is today, but with better demographics is basically what we were back then. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, the US today in the 2020s looks more like the UK. In the 1940s, which is they had a trade deficit, the industrial base was damaged by the war. You know, ours is damaged by outsourcing, but it's functionally similar at the end of the day. And so we have a weaker industrial base, weaker demographics, and no clear political unification or kind of external thing that we're rallying behind. And also we have social media, right? So before. You could do things like financial oppression. You could hold interest rates below the inflation rate for a long period of time. And, the average person couldn't tell you what are interest rates right now? What is inflation right now? Information moved very slow. It was only kind of available to those that were, reading like investment journals on paper. Right. And what most people were working hard. They didn't have time for that. Now we have social media. Now we have the internet, information, including bad information, but good and bad information can all travel around very quickly. And so, people are memeing about the fiscal dominance issue in real time and explaining things to people in a way that was not available 8 years ago. And so it's much harder to kind of get everyone in line and say, look, this is the plan we're doing. Instead, it's a much sloppier, longer process, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, do you think the SVB bank crisis in the spring of 2023 shows us an example of how the Fed blinks in the face of threats to financial stability and really shows us the most likely path forward for the Fed is to ease their higher interest rates for a longer stance?
I do, and that's a point that I made. So going back to my prior thing are interest rates stimulatory or depressing? If they let the private sector have the full negative consequences of those rates, then they would balance out or maybe even favor the disinflation still. If when they raise rates, if some banks go bankrupt, and importantly, if deposits that are above the FDIC insurance limit, if they get a haircut because they invested in a bank as unsecured creditors, and that bank went bankrupt because, ironically, they held risk-free assets with long duration. that would actually destroy some of the money supply. If you got $1 million in SVB, and you lose some of it, and FDIC insurance only covers some of it, and you lose a couple $100,000. You damage your spending power. You're gonna spend less, and therefore you're destroying money. You're destroying some consuming power, and it's ugly. But they didn't want to do that. They said, "Look, we want to raise interest rates," which ironically blows out the federal deficit. But at the same time, whenever these private sector things blow up too much, we're gonna bail those out. And so basically, they could have had deflation, but they didn't want the consequences, which would be people don't trust the banks anymore. at the end of the day, they're not really going to let the banking system become something that people don't trust anymore. And businesses have to kind of, you know, kind of have all these extra frictions of kind of spreading their money out so they're never above the FDIC limit. And they didn't want that. They didn't want kind of this, like, everybody checking all their banks' like financial statements, especially because a lot of banks aren't even public. Mm-hmm. How do you check a small bank's financial statements? And how do you prove that they're solvent? And so at the end of the day, they blinked and they said, look, we're going to keep increasing the interest rates, which blows out the federal deficit, but whenever there actually is private sector contraction, we're going to bail it out. It doesn't mean they're going to bail it everyone. For example, commercial real estate, there's really no cavalry coming there. But if it's a small enough market, they don't care. You know, $1 trillion or $2 trillion in losses of commercial real estate equity, they don't really care about, because it doesn't result in that kind of systemic instability. But banks, they care about. Function of the treasury market they care about. These are things that they blink whenever they have a problem with. And so you get that effect where, you know, the monetary policy becomes less flexible because of what's happening on the fiscal side. Mm-hmm.
You know, Lynn, we've spoken about the idea of the deficit blowing out and this idea of, you know, this debt rolling over and how much this ends up increasing the deficit year by year. Is this really only a one-way street, and is there anything that the Fed or the Treasury can really do about that?
Well, I mean, they can provide liquidity to Treasury markets. Basically, that their options narrow, and so you could get a case where the Fed has to go back to balance sheet expansion despite the fact that inflation's above their target. Mm-hmm. Or we've already seen the Treasury, for example, shortened their average duration of Treasury issuance. Which is, you know, it's a directionally similar to what you see in emerging markets when they have a fiscal crisis. It's not the extreme case where they might have their entire debt is like overnight paper, for example. That's extreme case, but it's directionally similar. That when you find, you know, back a year ago when the long end of the curve was kind of getting illiquid and the yields were going up pretty quickly, and then the Treasury started shortening their duration and issuing more T-bills and pulling capital out of reverse repos and back into the market. That's directionally an emerging market phenomenon. That's a fiscal dominance, fiscal long-term fiscal crisis type of issue. So yeah, the Fed and the Treasury have any number of things they can do to ensure liquidity in the Treasury markets. But the problem is they can't necessarily do that while also trying to keep financial conditions tight to fight inflation. So basically, it's like one of those two variables has to be a problem. Mm-hmm. And they're always going to, you know, 99 times out of 100, they're going to let the inflation fight weaken if it means saving the Treasury market or saving the you know, consumer deposits in banks or business mm-hmm. deposits in banks. So those are the two things that, you know, 99 times out of 100, they're going to save. You never say never, but, you know, if you had a bet, that's really that's where their incentives lie. Let's put mm-hmm. it like that. And so, yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of the situation they find themselves in. But we're you know, there's still cycles there. There's still periods of time where they push back. They, you know, they temporarily get inflation under control. They kind of put us into a light recession or a near recession. And that can put downward pressure on this. One of the problems is that whenever they slow down the economy to try to fight inflation, because the tax base is so financialized, if asset prices have a weak year, then the next year has pretty weak tax receipts. Mm-hmm. And so let's say they try to cut let's say in the unlikely event that Democrats or Republicans get together and say, we're going to cut the deficit by $500 trillion going forward mm-hmm. per year. It's a pretty big cut. It seems extremely unlikely they would do that. But let's say they manage to do it. Probably what would happen is GDP would slow down and then you'd have weaker asset prices. And then next year, you'd have weaker tax receipts. And so a good chunk of those cut deficits would actually come back because tax receipts would be weaker, which would be not the case if you had a less financialized economy. But because so much of our tax base is tied to asset prices, that's a fact that they have kind of built in. And so there's really not a lot of easy ways out of the situation other than just this ongoing debasement relative to scarcer things is kind of how they're going to do it. That you know, if at some point unemployment's getting bad, that becomes more politically painful, so they emphasize that more. If at some point inflation's getting bad, they try to emphasize that a little bit more, but they can't kind of return to equilibrium, at least for kind of any sort of reasonable investment horizon. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, I think those are some excellent explanations on exactly, you know, the problem that we find ourselves in. But Lynn, what are some of the outcomes, let's say at this point, if they meaningfully cut rates? You know, do we make a lot of assumptions in this environment about what has traditionally happened in a falling rate environment?
Well, they often cut rates because there's economic weakness, because their employment mandate is now beginning to take priority, or because there's some sort of instability that they're dealing with, right? For example, the banks having problems or the treasury market's having problems, something like that. And so, you know, if they were to cut rates, on some level, I don't think it'd be as stimulatory as people think, because part of, you know, it would actually reduce the deficits a little bit. On the other hand, it would probably increase oil prices or otherwise weaken the dollar relative to other currencies. And it would probably give those other, you know, so let's say emerging markets, they have a lot of dollars on mid debt. So when the dollar hardens relative to their other currency cash flows, it squeezes them, it slows them down, it reduces their growth rate for energy consumption, things like that. It has a somewhat disinflationary effect there. If they cut interest rates, it gives them more breathing room, and therefore they probably grow a little quicker. They probably consume a little bit more energy, which around the margins is inflationary. Mm-hmm. And the hallmark of fiscal dominance is that whether you keep rates high or you try to reduce rates, they both have inflationary aspects to them, just through different mechanisms. If you keep rates high, you're inflating through huge deficits in your interest expense. If you cut rates, then you're having fewer foreigners want to hold your currency, and you're probably increasing the expense of energy and things like that, at least all else being equal. Mm-hmm. So I think overall, rates are less important going forward than some of the other variables that are at play here.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's an excellent way to put it, because we're really facing this time, as you say, that we're, you know, the sword is cutting both ways. But what do these easing periods historically mean for harder assets like gold and maybe commodities?
So they should be good for commodities, but again, it depends on why they're easing. Right. Mm-hmm. If some of these deflationary forces do temporarily override the fiscal force, then the moment they cut rates, you might not get a jump in commodity prices, because the falling in demand is a bigger factor. But I think over the longer term, you know, should they find themselves having to ease for a variety of reasons, I do think you'd get increases over multi-year period in gold, in energy, potentially in copper and other commodities like that. And so right now they're running pretty hawkish policy, which keeps the dollar strong, which keeps, you know, kind of indebted emerging markets more slowly growing. But if they do have to cut, you know, you probably get a little bit of a boom in Latin America. You probably get a little bit of a boom in South Asia. That probably is good for commodity prices. It's probably good for commodity prices in dollar terms. Whether that happens in the 6 months, you know, after the cut, it depends on the reasons. But I think that's a more structural story. Mm-hmm.
So Lynn, how important is it for you to have energy exposure in your portfolio?
I mean, I consider it very important. You know, if you look at a classic 60-40 portfolio, 60% bonds, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, it's geared toward two major outcomes that keep going back and forth. The stock segment is mainly geared toward disinflationary economic growth. So things, you know, commodities are abundant, we're building new technology, we're building new things, the economy's growing. That's when stocks do well. And the bond component is there for when there's a recession and you know, stocks perform poorly and interest rates go down and people flock to safe assets. Usually bond yields go down, bond prices go up. And so by putting those together, they're good for disinflationary growth or kind of deflationary credit contraction. Those are the kind of two scenarios that they are optimized to oscillate between. But what that portfolio is badly geared toward is inflation. If you have significant currency debasement, if you have higher costs of input kind of base materials like energy, copper, things like that, labor, then both stocks and bonds can do poorly together. If you look at the prior four inflationary decades in modern U.S. history, 1910s, the 1940s, the 1970s, and to some extent the 2000s decade. Those were periods where, you know, energy got more expensive. Most commodities got more expensive. Gold usually did well. And corporate margins were pressured by a lot of these higher input costs. Bonds were pressured by these higher rates, higher inflation. And so usually the 60-40 portfolio did bad in all four of those inflationary periods. Whereas if you owned energy assets, if you owned a mix of things that are more inflationary in general, if you own the things that are going up and pressuring stocks and bonds, that there's your diversifier. And so I think in general, a kind of stock, bond, and energy slash commodity slash hard money, that kind of triune portfolio is generally over, say, a 100-year period, more balanced than just a 60-40 stock bond portfolio. So I think owning energy is very useful in a portfolio slice, and it, you know, not at a tiny amount either. So a big enough amount that it can actually protect some of your other assets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some ways, acting as a hedge against some of your other risks for these, you know, these times that it always seems like we're pushing on both sides of the scale and one's winning out versus the other. But Lynn, yeah, how do you think about breaking apart, you know, exposure to energy? Energy is such a broad term. Are you thinking about, you know, separating green energy versus oil and gas versus nuclear? You know, is it producers versus utilities? How do you go about analyzing that problem?
So yeah, when I say energy, I primarily mean dense forms of energy. So either owning the energy outright, so, you know, owning oil, owning natural gas, owning uranium, or owning their producers, assuming you can buy them at reasonable valuations and that they're financially healthy enough to get through cycles. Those are the types of assets that should do pretty well. You know, there's also, there's drillers, there's energy transporters. Again, that depends on valuation. But having exposure to assets that should do well if oil and gas and uranium go higher, or coal, those assets are generally what protects you. So again, it could be owning the commodity, or it could be owning any business equity that benefits either from more volumes happening or from prices going up. So you know, for me, I like the producers with a smaller mix of, you know, pipelines and drillers, for example. That's why I play it. In the uranium sector, I play it a little bit differently. I mainly focus on owning the uranium, but in the oil and gas space, I focus on owning a lot of the producers and other companies.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, you know, you're such an intellect and you take such deep dives into many of these different topics. I recently did a podcast with a demographics expert, and he was explaining to me how he sees the demographics issue going forward for the world, for China, for the US. How do you take that into account when you're trying to understand these macroeconomic forces and what they mean for the world?
So part of it is you have to understand, I think there's two main variables here. One is that when a country ages in isolation, that's different than if multiple countries age together, mm-hmm, demographics wise. So when Japan, for example, ages first, it means that a lot of demand for things goes down, but they're still heavily supplied because the rise of China and the rise of the rest of the world is plenty of labor and plenty of production. And so that's a fairly disinflationary combination. But if you have the whole world age together, if China ages, if the United States ages, if Europe ages, if Japan's aging, then there's no kind of rising young power that's big enough to offset a lot of that. That's one variable. Number two is how we structure, again, this goes back to fiscal dominance, how we structure our fiscal situation to account for demographics. When people think of aging demographics, they generally think of less demand because generally older individuals, mm-hmm, consume less than younger individuals. You know, they're not buying a bigger house and starting a family and having all those expenses, right? So, you know, a lot of historically, a high percentage of the elderly population was kind of financially struggling. because they no longer have kind of active incomes. And so only the percentage that save significantly or are able to consume at high levels. But in a world where we have very kind of large Medicare and very large Social Security, the elderly population is not as impoverished. If anything, in the United States, a lot of the wealth is held by baby boomer generation. Mm-hmm. We've kind of top-heavied our assets toward the older demographic. And so they're going on vacations, they're traveling the world, they're buying sports cars, they're spending. And so a shift in demographics means in this case that the older side is still spending, and yet there's fewer younger workers to meet that demand. And so some of those accumulated assets, some of those stocks, some of those bonds, some of those real estate, that's being turned into consumption. And there's not enough people to necessarily provide all that. And even China's aging now, for example. And so I think the demographics, while they're a big variable, they're not the only variable. And I would argue that they're not as disinflationary as some of the advocates for that are, mm-hmm. and that the fiscal dominance is a bigger inflationary variable than the demographics. So for me, the demographics is not really the disinflationary variable I think about. What I think about is, how deflationary is AI going to be, or what are the new sources of energy that could come online that give us disinflation in energy? Those are the two variables that I look at for, what could make the inflationary thesis not be as inflationary as I expect. Mm-hmm. I look at those things as a bigger variable than I look at demographics, because of how we structured where our assets are, where our fiscal spending goes. It's demographics doesn't, I would argue, have the impact people think it does. Mm-hmm.
So if we take an example like China with this aging workforce, are they able to in some ways export or import the labor that they need to continue that manufacturing base at the pace that they have?
So I think they can continue it, but the question is, can they grow it? Because inflation is rate of change, right, around the margin. So, during the 2000s decade, for example, energy prices got very high. It should have been a pretty inflationary decade, but you had this massive rise of China and offshoring and cheap manufactured goods. And so even though the energy component was going up, which is normally inflationary, it was offset by basically what is tech productivity. We had internet communications. It's easier for companies to manage offshore sites, automation. Industrial automation, these things were all getting better at a rapid pace. And therefore, they kept the cost of like sneakers and shirts and computers and toys all down compared to their energy input component. But going forward, if we still have that in place, but we're not getting exponentially better at it, if we're not exponentially better at making a computer than we were 10 years ago, if we're not exponentially better at making plastic toys than we were 10 years ago, if we're not exponentially better at making sneakers and shirts anymore, mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that those things blow up in price, but it means that they're not falling in price at a rapid enough pace to offset the increase in prices elsewhere. So for example, the 2000s decade, hospital services, anything that you couldn't outsource was going up pretty significantly. Hospital services, childcare services, kind of these domestic, education services, these like domestic things were actually inflating at like 5-6% a year or more. Whereas some of the other things had a negative inflation rate. And so on average, they'd be like, look, we have 3% inflation because you had inflation plus disinflation. And if we enter a more deglobalizing world, or a world where certain technologies grow more slowly because they've already kind of reached their total addressable market, you have fewer disinflationary offsets to some of those inflationary things. Now, I think the big variable to look out for is that some of the white collar work this time might get more disinflationary. The cost of hiring accounting services is probably not going to go up very much because AI allows one accountant to do the work of, say, two accountants, right? And so the wage pressure on accountants goes down. Some percentage of accountants, go look elsewhere for work, which pushes down wages in other fields. And so I do think that white collar work probably won't have very significant wage growth, which probably is a disinflationary variable to consider among all these other variables. Whereas, for example, I think a lot of blue collar work, you know, going to someone's home and like checking their HVAC system, or you know, electricians, plumbers, people working on transmission lines, welders. That's where I think that probably inflation is still going to be, you know, wage inflation is probably still going to be pretty significant. And so I think it's a mix like that.
Seems like a very cyclical problem in a lot of ways, much like, you know, the underinvestment in the mining industry. Is this underinvestment and under entry into these blue collar fields as well?
Yeah, I think in the United States, the message for the past, call it 30 years, was don't go into blue collar, go into finance, go into medicine or pharmacy, you know, corporate, you know, kind of pharmaceuticals, go into software. And don't be an electrician, don't be a plumber, don't be a HVAC installer or maintainer. Don't be the person who's, you know, building transmission lines. Don't be a technician. And I think that's now, like you said, we've underinvested there. And there's nothing quickly coming. There's, you know, the timeline for like robots that can come to our house, they can drive to our house and fix our HVAC system, is not on their, let's say, investment horizon. You know, maybe one day, but not in the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. Whereas outsourcing some of our accounting, for example, or, you know, just our accountant can handle more clients because, you know, he's automated a lot of his tools, for example, and he's got a thinking machine helping him. He's got two more employees, and they just happen to be AI employees, mm-hmm. right? And so that's where we have cost savings. That's where we have more wage competition. But there's not a lot of, you know, wage competition elsewhere. Now, this is a political issue, but immigration is one of the factors that affects things like, you know, the more physical jobs, right? That's where you could get wage disinflation, is if you have that geographic arbitrage. If people from one market are coming to a more expensive market, and therefore they're pushing down domestic blue collar wages, that is a variable that could be disinflationary as well. But then it becomes a matter of skilled blue collar versus quote unquote less skilled blue collar, things that have a higher degree of training or expertise, mm-hmm. versus things that, you know, anyone who's kind of willing to work could pick them up in a matter of weeks or a couple months. That's where you could see a difference there because of the immigration component. So any macro thing like this has a lot of variables to look at, but that's why when I can look at all variables together, I try to be data dependent, mm-hmm. while having a trend in mind. And my general trend is fiscal driven inflation with some of these, you know, disinflationary offsets.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, let's say the skilled immigration versus unskilled immigration. And as political of a topic as that is right now, it's important to really try to remember and focus on the abilities and the skills that some of the immigrants that are coming to this country or whatever country, and what they can actually not only produce, but what skills they can actually contribute to the workforce.
Yeah. And I mean, as an example, and putting immigration aside, in the United States, there's an effort to reshore semiconductor manufacturing. It is considered a national strategic security issue. But they ran into headwinds. They were able to build the facilities pretty quickly. But when it came time to getting all these highly skilled technicians to actually run the place, mm-hmm. they realized they don't have enough. We don't have enough in the United States. There are very good skilled technicians. There's just not enough of them because it's not been what our economy has incentivized people to go into. And so they were like, look, we're over cost and behind schedule, because we can't get affordable, high quality technicians. And so they're literally like, well, can we plane some in from Taiwan? Because that's where the skilled semiconductor technicians are. Or can we, you know, move them from XYZ? And then of course you get people pushing back and say, well, what, you're saying we don't have enough here? And it's like, well, yes, that's what we're saying. Because we've, you know, it, and you can start to incentivize that. I mean, if the wages for some of these kind of skilled, either blue collar or mixed collar, you know, technicians versus say software designers, for example, technicians of, I'm not sure I call it blue collar, but it's, mm-hmm. it's a mix. It's highly technical. You know, over time, those wages can go up and draw more people to go into those fields, but that's a multi-year retraining cycle. That's human capital that takes time to build up. And so that's why some of these programs to say reshore semiconductors or to build out our electricity transmission system better, they end up being more inflationary than expected because it's hard to find the people to do it. All of the production capabilities, it's like a muscle we haven't used in a very long time. And so it's not very efficient when it is used. That's what, you know, the United States kind of finds itself in.
Yeah, it's funny how the reality of that situation is much different than, you know, the theory of it or just thinking about it before it's implemented.
Yeah.
So Lynn, you know, we spoke a lot about the 60/40 portfolio and you kind of touched on a couple of these other ideas. What are some of the other examples of portfolios that have done well as an alternative to this 60/40 setup, like the IV portfolio or the permanent portfolio?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different ones. What they generally have in common is they put something in that's not stocks or bonds. It's usually gold or commodities or energy or some mix. So the permanent portfolio is 25% stocks, 25% bonds, 25% cash or cash equivalents, and 25% gold. The IV portfolio has five different segments, 20% each. It's stocks, it's bonds, it's real estate, it's commodities. I forget the fifth one offhand. I think gold. And that one only stays in a given slice if it has positive momentum, if it's above its, say, 10-month moving average. And there's a
number
of different...
Otherwise, you move to cash, right?
Otherwise, you move that particular slice to cash. Yeah, you don't stay in something that's structurally going down.
Or maybe short-term treasuries or something.
Yeah, some cash equivalents that your T-bills count, money markets count. Mm-hmm. And so there are different portfolio constructions. They depend on how active you want to be. For example, you might want to tweak it over time. Let's say your gold slice has some gold and some Bitcoin now, perhaps. You can choose between commodities versus more energy specific. But what they generally do is they put things that are not stocks or bonds. They don't have profit margins in the same way. They have other things. And the challenging thing about commodities is that they spend more time doing bad than they spend time doing good, right? If you look at long-term performance, commodities are not great. They usually have like two bad decades and then one good decade and then two bad decades and one good decade. It just so happens that good decade tends to be when stocks and bonds are not having a good decade. So from a portfolio diversifier standpoint, having a slice is good. Too much of something can be bad. So if you just are heavily a commodity investor for decades, if you're not a top one, you're probably going to have a rough time. But by having a slice in a portfolio, it actually makes that portfolio better, especially if you lean into it after a long period of it being a bear market and underinvested in and inexpensive. And then, you know, when that is now it's been ruling the market for 5-10 years, that's when you dial that down. And of course, this is hard, but basically just leaning into things that are cheap and underinvested and leaning out of things that are expensive and overinvested is kind of, you know, every decade or so, just kind of reassessing where is the pendulum swung and how can I start kind of balancing back toward the middle, I think is a useful way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I like that idea of taking a very long-term view on these assets and then rebalancing or moving to cash based on, you know, this longer term at or below the moving average.
Yeah, I think momentum investors have been successful in that regard, especially when you have momentum segmented into different categories. That's not a specific strategy I use, but that's a strategy that historically does work pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, I wanted to get your take on the advent of the Bitcoin ETFs and if you see them, you know, as a positive for the adoption and network effects of Bitcoin, or if this just allows greater control of the market by institutions wanting to silence this monetary smoke alarm.
So in general, I think it's a net positive, but more like I just classify it as an inevitability. Any trillion-dollar asset that's liquid is likely going to get ETFs. And you know, it doesn't matter what that asset is, it's likely going to get ETFs. Now, Bitcoin, Grayscale already had like 600,000 Bitcoin in it before. And so part of what we're seeing is a rotation out of Grayscale and into all these other ETFs, namely BlackRock and Fidelity. The total amount is going up, but it's still a fairly small percentage of all Bitcoin that exists. There are nearly 20 million Bitcoin out there, and there's still fewer than a million in ETFs, so fewer than 5%. if that hits 2 million one day, that could be 10% of all Bitcoin. And yet the price that would happen to Bitcoin if ETFs hold 2 million of it is going to be very high, I would argue. And so I think it's an inevitable thing that Bitcoin has to go through. I do think that, you know, especially for holders of those ETFs, there are risks. So, you know, when countries have fiscal crises, they're more likely to go after honeypots of value, you know, and so there are risks of hacks, there are risks of confiscations. But I think in general, what we're seeing in the developed world is they understand that Bitcoin's here to stay. They don't mind it as a kind of a walled garden store of value. And they're putting more political pressure on Bitcoin usage as a medium of exchange, Bitcoin usage held individually, Bitcoin used privately. Those are the things they don't like. And I think that's where the frontier is for kind of the cypherpunks, which is keeping Bitcoin legal to use, finding ways to use it, even if there's legal pressures against it. So I don't really view it as necessarily a huge positive or a huge negative. I just think it's an inevitability that if it ever got to this point of success, it's inevitable that ETFs would be built on it. And it comes down to, is the asset good enough to survive that attempt?
Yeah.
And so I think it is, but it's important to keep building the tools that allow people to move it around very efficiently, that allow people to hold it very efficiently, that allow people to get privacy on it pretty efficiently. I think that's all important work to do in the face of these ETFs that will try to gobble up some of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to think about what the value of Bitcoin and or gold, you know, these two hard assets would need to be to really paint a target on its back as a honeypot that would, you know, sufficiently offset the amount of debt and financialization that the system really has.
Yeah. So I would say at $1 trillion market cap or $1.5 trillion market cap, Bitcoin's not big enough. The way I would phrase it, so when you get into fiscal dominance, a classic playbook that developed countries did in the 40s, and 30s, and emerging markets do on a regular basis today, is they try to do capital controls. They say, look, you have to own these bonds, or you have to keep your money in banks that are owning these bonds, or you have to do X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. If you try to move capital globally, there's going to be financial walls against it. And Bitcoin is peer-to-peer value transfer. It's mobile capital. And so, you know, if you're a billionaire and you got Bitcoin in some multi-sig, you know, you can travel the world and be able to access your Bitcoin. Or you can literally memorize 12 words and bring your Bitcoin with you, or write it on a sheet of paper, or put it in an encrypted file somewhere. There's multiple ways to kind of transport that value. That's something that governments facing fiscal dominance and trying to turn to financial oppression generally won't look kindly on. And so that's kind of a battleground. The defense against that, I mentioned before at the beginning of the show, back in the 1940s, politics was very unified. It was like, we're all in this together. One party had a supermajority. That's how you could do things like ban gold ownership, or like, you know, they put Japanese Americans in camps, right? There were extreme actions taken back then in the United States because things had just, the pendulum had gone so far to one side that you had a supermajority that could kind of override checks and balances and do things like that. Mm-hmm. In a more polarized environment, the downside is nothing really gets done. Like, there's no real fixes to these things, at least from the government layer. But it also means it's harder for them to do draconian pushback against what the private sector is doing. It's harder for them to all unify and say, we're going to go after these people, or we're going to go after this asset, or we're going to, you know, do this organized financial repression. You know, something that China can do fairly effectively, but that, you know, the United States, for example, is probably going to be less effective at because of how polarized we are, which from an individual liberty standpoint is a good thing. And so that's kind of the messy environment we find ourselves in, is that some of the things that are causing the problem, that is, you know, the kind of the unconstrained fiscal deficits, the kind of the structural imbalances that have built up, the institutional consolidation and malaise that's happening, those are problems. But at the same time, some of that is also defense, because it's messy enough that solutions can be left kind of, you know, unchecked for a period of time. There'll be frictions put on them, but probably no kill shot because it's hard for them to organize a kill shot. Let's put it like that.
Right. So, Lynn, does the issuance of all of this debt and how the U.S. has, in some respects, used the dollar as a weapon against much of the rest of the world, does this make the argument for you needing an improvement in our financial system? And is that what inspired you to write your book, Broken Money?
Yeah. So, I mean, I spent years analyzing the current system, and mostly what I'm analyzing is why things are broken, right? It's like, what is this problem? How is this investable, or how does this impact investments for positive or negative? And generally what we've seen is that, you know, with all the countries kind of relying on the dollar, it has two big effects. One is that all those countries kind of become vessels of the United States, which is that, you know, if they're holding a lot of dollars and the dollar devalues, they can get their savings rug pulled. They're funding deficit spending in the United States by holding, you know, treasuries at negative real rates, for example. On the other hand, if they have dollar-dominated debts and the United States wants to fight inflation or squeeze some of those countries, they can jack interest rates up and say, you know, here's this Latin American country. They have all this dollar-dominated debt. We're going to harden their debt so much, and then we're going to only give them a swap line or only kind of give them assistance if they agree to have a military base in their country or, you know, join this thing or do this thing that aligns with us. Or maybe nothing political. Maybe we want to crush their ability to buy oil, mm-hmm. to lower the oil prices for us, right? And so if your savings and your debts are denominated in a unit that someone else has unilateral control over, they have power over you. So that's the downside. And they can literally just freeze your assets too. That's the downside for the rest of the world. The downside for the US is that we've, you know, due to network effects and due to some decisions, you know, 50 years ago and even longer, there's so much demand for dollars out there that dollars have a monetary premium on them compared to other fiat currencies. And so the only way to kind of meet that demand globally is to run these big structural trade deficits. That's how our dollars get out into the world, to meet that demand for dollars. And it does show by boosting our import power and decreasing our export competitiveness, especially for lower margin things like industrials. And so we run these structural trade deficits, which feels great for a period of time. If you're not some of the people getting offshored, if you're not some of the people that are getting, you're on the wrong side of the trade deficit. But if you work in finance, healthcare, government, you don't really have the negative effects, and you feel great from all the lower cost stuff that's happening. The problem is that eventually it happens so much, you deindustrialize and it becomes a national security issue. You realize that during a pandemic, you can't make ventilators, for example, or you can't make masks, or you know, your military components are made in China, which you now have a, you know, partially military adversary with, right? Mm-hmm. There, you get into these awkward situations, and so then you start to get the kind of the pendulum swinging back, mm-hmm. and so the U.S. is actually it's gone on far enough and big enough that the U.S. has kind of harmed itself by this. And so that's why I think the system is very messy right now. I think it's going to be a very long process still to change it. But there's a gradual shift from countries and people toward more neutral assets. So on the sovereign level, a lot of that is gold. You see reduced treasury purchases of central banks and increased gold purchases of central banks. You also see that among private individuals, in especially in Asia. And then also the people, you know, they can buy things like Bitcoin, they can buy gold. There's kind of this shift toward these more neutral assets, especially as the U.S. fiscal situation gets less attractive. If more countries realize the only way out of this is inflation, it makes holding those bonds for the long term less attractive, mm-hmm. especially if they can also get frozen, confiscated, and things like that. So I think that we are seeing a transition, but I'm talking like a multi-decade transition. Usually monetary systems and global financial systems, you know, there's always like these big shocks that happen at once, like the 1971, you know, DPEG, or, you know, the freezing of Russian reserves in 2022. These watershed moments that happen to various magnitudes, but, you know, leading up to those moments and in the aftermath of those moments, there's still these long grinding transitions that take place because network effects are very powerful. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Lynn. Well, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up for today. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about?
No, I think that covers it. I think when you look at macro, you want to kind of separate multiple variables that are pushing back on each other, mm-hmm. and then try to figure out which one's likely to be bigger in your investment horizon. I think a lot of people focus on this one component and then they ignore other components, or they on the other side, they focus on the other component and ignore the other person's component. You have to try to picture all components together, estimate which one seems to be bigger or more powerful, or the incentives are more aligned to make that one happen, and then monitor the data to see if that is happening or something surprising is happening and other variables are winning. So I think the combination of understanding the push and pull that happens between different forces and then being data dependent over time just to see how they're playing out.
Excellent. Of course, for anybody that would like to hear more from Lynn or read her newsletter, that's all available at lynnalden.com, and as well, excellent Twitter follow at Lynn Alden Contact. Lynn, thanks so much for coming on today to help us understand how a lot of these countervailing forces are really trying to balance themselves out in the world. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.